a professor at the Baylor College of Medicine. He's also head of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development in Houston, Texas, and an author. The doctor's latest book is Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. U.S. President Donald Trump is in France for the G7 summit. But before leaving Washington, he took time to ratchet up trade pressure on China as he announced hikes in a series of already existing tariffs. And Mr. Trump again insisted he was the right person to take on China. Today, he had a private lunch with French President Emmanuel Macron, the summit host. Meanwhile, G7 expectations are said to be low, though the president today sounded upbeat.
So far, so good. The weather is perfect. The guest is fantastic. Everybody's getting along. And I think we'll accomplish a lot this weekend.
European Council President Donald Tusk admits there are many tough challenges for the Group of Seven and few easy answers.
This is another G7 summit, which will be a difficult test of unity and solidarity of the free world and its leaders. There is still no certainty whether the group will be able to find common solutions, and the global challenges are today really serious.
And Tusk put special emphasis today on trade wars.
Trade wars will lead to recession, while trade deals will boost the economy. Not to mention the fact that trade wars among G7 members will lead to eroding the already weakened trust among us.
As anti-government protests enter their third month, there has been more street violence in Hong Kong today, as demonstrators clash with police in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory. Officers use tear gas to disperse a crowd outside a police station. There is also word that pro-democracy leaders are planning to once again target Hong Kong Airport. They have called for blockading roadways to the airport complex. To stay up to date on all the world's news, we invite you online to voanews.com. There is also a convenient VOA mobile app. From Washington, this is VOA News. Britain's Prince Andrew has denied any personal knowledge of criminal behavior by his one-time friend, billionaire Jeffrey Epstein, who killed himself in a jail in New York while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. AP correspondent Charles Ledesma is in London.
Prince Andrew, also known as the Duke of York, has said in a new statement, "At no stage during the limited time I spent with Jeffrey Epstein did I see, witness, or suspect any behavior of the sort that subsequently led to his arrest and conviction." Epstein was convicted in 2008 after pleading guilty to prostitution-related state charges and serving 13 months behind bars. Andrew has again said it was a mistake to visit Epstein after his release in 2010. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Liberal U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has completed a three-week course of radiation therapy to treat a cancerous tumor on her pancreas. The 86-year-old justice, who has been treated for pancreatic cancer before, reportedly tolerated the therapy well, and a court spokeswoman said no further treatment was required at this time. There is a health issue in the news here in the United States that could have global implications. Officials in the state of Illinois are reporting a lung disease death tied to vaping. We get a report from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
While vaping had been considered a safer alternative than smoking, the first death has been recorded in the U.S. linked to electronic smoking devices. The Illinois Department of Health says it was an adult patient who'd become ill after vaping and added that the severity of illness is alarming and users need to be warned. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says since June, nearly 200 people around the country have contracted severe respiratory illnesses after vaping, but researchers haven't yet identified a clear-cut cause. I'm Jackie Quinn.
A Russian Soyuz spacecraft today failed to dock with the orbiting International Space Station. NASA says the Soyuz failed to properly lock onto its docking target. Russian officials say there is another attempt at linking up set for Monday. North Korea has conducted another ballistic missile test, violating an apparent promise to President Trump to end such testing after the conclusion of U.S.-South Korean military exercises. Japan first reported the two launches and Seoul confirmed it minutes later, saying the North had fired two projectiles into the sea off its eastern coast. A senior U.S. official told VOA, quote, "We are consulting closely with our Japanese and South Korean allies." The United Nations reports nearly 2 months of heavy rains and flooding in Sudan have wiped out livelihoods, made tens of thousands of people homeless, and created a humanitarian emergency. More than 50 people have died from the torrential rains that have hit Sudan since the beginning of July. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The South Sudanese deserve the capacity to have peace in their own country. And this is why for IGAD it is important to support this peace process and to make it possible that the South Sudanese people can live also in freedom and fear of anything, political suppression and whatsoever, and in democracy in their own country.
The Intergovernmental Authority on Development recommends plans for the implementation of the South Sudanese Peace Agreement.
Appointment to cabinet is the prerogative of the president, and President Barrow has done a due consultation with the right people that advised him, and they settled for these two individuals.
The Gambian President Adama Barrow reshuffles his cabinet.
If they will take him to court, I'm ready to represent him. If they acquit him, they release him on bail, that is well and good if they are not intended to go to court. But we are ready. If they plan to go to court, we are ready to represent our client.
And the Tanzanian government arrests and charges a journalist for spreading false information. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Foreign Affairs Ministers from the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, met this week to discuss the implementation of the South Sudanese Peace Accord. Following the meeting, the foreign ministers recommended that regional leaders organize a face-to-face meeting of the top leadership of the South Sudanese parties and stakeholders to discuss and resolve outstanding issues regarding the peace agreement. They also urged their respective heads of state to ask South Sudanese President Salva Kiir to disburse the balance of the pledged $100 million while ensuring accountability and transparency in the process. To learn more about the regional bloc's meeting, I reached Ambassador Dr. Ismail Ways, IGAD Special Envoy for South Sudan.
The main purpose was to engage the parties and the stakeholders on the peace process. And all the IGAD member states were present in that meeting, as well as all the parties and the stakeholders. And the main purpose was to deal with the two main outstanding issues. Number one, the number of states and the boundaries. And number two, the ceasefire and the transitional security arrangements, especially the cantonment process.
In the communique that was sent around after the meeting, the Council of Ministers pledged to engage their respective heads of state and government to directly engage President Salva Kiir to disburse the balance of the pledge, $100 million U.S. dollars, transparently. Why is this necessary?
Well, as you know, the peace process, you can't have it for free. And it requires, in fact, resources. And South Sudan is a government is the first country that really should invest on the peace process in South Sudan. As you remember, the government has pledged $100 million, and This money is coming very slowly, and this affects also the peace process. That's why the ministers have decided to engage their superiors, the heads of the state, to engage the president to pay the parliament. And that is a very important step. And as you know, the deadline of November 12 is coming, and by then, everything will be too late if this money comes also very late.
So far, what do you see as the progress report on the ongoing efforts to fully implement the recently signed agreement between Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar?
Well, the progress so far of this peace agreement is, as you know, since the signing of this agreement, the guns are silenced. At the same time, the humanitarian situation have improved. The refugees in the neighboring countries, a good number of them are coming back to the country. And even the displaced people within South Sudan are also returning to their homes. These are very positive signs. And as you also know, most of the opposition groups, except only one person indeed, are all now back in Juba and are doing their implementation of this peace agreement from within. And that one person is Dr. Riek Machar, the designated first vice president of the Republic of South Sudan. And the engagement now of the ministers and IGAD in general is in part also to supplement and this effort that the South Sudanese are doing. And if you read the communique, the ministers have acknowledged the positive effects and the positive contribution of the political parties.
Talking about Dr. Riek Machar, the communique further recommends heads of state and government to hold an ordinary summit of IGAD in mid-September, that is next month, to deliberate on and decide, among others, the status of Dr. Riek Machar. Why is this necessary as part of the implementation of the peace process?
Now, Dr. Riek Machar is free to move within the region and even outside the region. But he himself wants to have a word said by the heads of the state that he is free in his movements without any limitation. Now we have a progress. And the progress is now the Council of Ministers have decided to hold a summit in the first 2 weeks of September. It is important because it will allow Dr. Riek Machar to have the statement he requires from the head of state that he is free in his movement within and outside the region.
What is the way forward in this IGAD-led effort to restore peace stability in South Sudan?
Well, the way forward is very clear. Like any nation in this region, the South Sudanese people are tired of fighting. They are tired of being refugees in the neighboring country. They are tired of hunger and of also all those negative impacts which are related to war. So therefore, the South Sudanese deserve, in fact, to have peace in their own country. And this is why for IGAD it is important to support this peace process and to make it possible that the South Sudanese people can live also in freedom and fear of anything political, suppression and whatsoever, and in democracy in their own country. With this, we are cooperating with all the political parties and the people of South Sudan who are ready for this.
Ambassador Dr. Ismael Ways is IGAD Special Envoy for South Sudan. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The defense lawyer for the arrested Tanzanian journalist Joseph Gandhi says his client will be acquitted of the charges against him. Jones Sendudu says the charges are unfounded, arguing that Gandhi ensured his documentary was well balanced, which he says met journalistic standards. But he was arrested and charged with publishing false information after his documentary about alleged police brutality aired on Watetezi TV on August 9. Gandhi had investigated a report of police forcing six detained men to sodomize each other in Iringa, a town in central Tanzania. Defense lawyer Sendedo tells me he is confident his client will be acquitted of what he says are trumped up charges.
So recently he made an
investigation after obtaining a tip from a victim that police in Iringa, especially Mafinga police station, were torturing detainees, remandees, forcing them to go against the order of nature. And so he made an investigation and came up with a documentary that police in Iringa have been alleged to order, to force people to assault others and to go against the order of nature. The regional police commander confirmed, and he went further to interview the victims, and they confirmed that they have been forced to do the act. He went to the industry that the victims were working, and some of the co-workers also confirmed that they saw the videos and pictures which were taken when these people were tortured.
Some supporters of the government are saying that the news that Joseph put out was was unfortunate because it doesn't have evidence, and that this is fake news, which is against the recent laws that have been passed and implemented, and that this could create unnecessary tension in Tanzania and disgrace people, and that is why he has to face the full rigors of the law. How do you respond to that?
Speaking from the angle of journalist professionalism and ethics, the story was balanced all sides, because he interviewed the victims and also the regional police commander. But also, he had evidence, the PF3, police force number 3, which was written by the doctor in Iringa, confirmed that those victims were tortured, and some of them had some pain. And so that was a proof that at least the doctor has proved that that incident occurred, the torture occurred. The Cyber Crimes Act, which is now being used to harass people in Tanzania, the section that they are using is Section 16. It can be applied unjustly, because who determines that this is a false information? By the time the court determines that this was not a false information, you have already suffered in police custody.
Senator, but do you think he will be acquitted based on what you described as a journalistically well-crafted story?
I think he'll be acquitted based on the evidence I have and based on the documentary that we have. The problem now is I have heard that there are still wants to force to interrogate my client to come to the police station to identify the police that tortured the victim. Now, that is not the work of my client. That is the work of the victim, because at the day when the torture occurred, my client was not there. So I think here they are trying to create another case which does not relate to publishing false information.
What is next in this legal process in store for your client?
They said they are conducting a new interrogation, so we are waiting to hear what the interrogation will be all about. And then afterwards, we will see if they will take him to court. I'm ready to represent him. If they acquit him, they release him on bail, that is well and good, if they are not intended to go to court. But we are ready. If they plan to go to court, we are ready to represent our client.
Jones Sendodo is the defense lawyer for the Tanzanian journalist Joseph Gandhi. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt. Hooray! If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request for our show. I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it, yeah. Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time every weekday in August for your chance to win.
The Ugandan government has cancelled the licenses of over a dozen non-governmental organizations or NGOs for allegedly financially supporting opposition parties and a group led by parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine. Meanwhile, the government has also directed the NGOs to provide financial information regarding their donors list, budgets, and other additional documents to the administration. For reaction, I reach Godbert Tumushabe, the associate director at the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies, a Ugandan NGO.
If you recall, in September of 2017, security agencies attacked a number of NGOs, including ActionAid International in Uganda, my own organization, the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies, and they raided our offices, took away our property, and even at that time, they actually asked about 30 organizations to provide the same information. In this particular case, it is not the NGOs that have been requested to submit the information. It's actually the Financial Intelligence Authority wrote to the banks, asking the banks to submit this information. So that is basically what is new now. And it's not surprising for me because in 2017, this was the time President Museveni was working to amend the constitution to remove presidential age limit to allow him contest for all presidency perpetually. In this particular case, I think that a lot of this is really triggered by the panic that is accompanying the run-up to the next elections in 2021.
Supporters of the ruling National Resistance Movement believe that there's need to streamline activities of NGOs in the country and that these NGOs hide behind opposition groups to have a change agenda. And that is why there's need for the authorities to find out who is doing what and who is helping who in Uganda. This is their argument.
The argument holds no water because the work that all these organizations do is legitimate work. The organizations that are targeted are involved in governance work, work that promotes respect for human rights, work that is around electoral reform, around civic rights and election rights. So in short, these are organizations actually that engage in work that is neutral. Because if you are educating citizens about their voting rights, I don't see how that affects one political group and not the other. So what we are seeing with the current attack on NGOs is very, very fairly consistent with all Africa's long-serving politicians like Museveni and others, because whenever these leaders overstay in power, their legitimacy continues to diminish, their ability to hang on over you through credible electoral processes diminish, and then they start really, you know, closing in on civic organizations like we are seeing in Uganda.
With this measure coming up, how are Ugandans reacting to it, and those in the NGO community in Uganda, what has been the response since you are one of them, you've interacted with them, what is the general consensus?
In this particular incident, actually, the NGO leaders of the 13 organizations, we met last week, and essentially we were all agreed that this is basically a consistent pattern of persecution that we have been seeing gaining momentum as the regime democracy credentials continue to diminish. So that is not lost on our minds. But secondly, the letter that was written by the Financial Intelligence Authority was actually leaked from one of the banks. So there is no official communication whatsoever to any of our organizations. And so essentially, we couldn't really speak more authoritatively in terms of a response. And sadly, as law-abiding citizens, we acknowledge the legitimacy of a state institution like Financial Intelligence Authority to ask for information for whatever reason. But we believe that at this moment, most of these institutions are actually being used by the dictatorship. They are being used as instruments of dictatorship to undermine civic organizing, to undermine citizens. And therefore, we take serious exception that the Financial Intelligence Authority, instead of it working with the Uganda National NGO Bureau, which is the legitimate regulatory agency of NGOs in Uganda, is actually going underhand and going to ask for this information without any prima facie case against this organization.
Godbert Tumushabe is the associate director at the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies, a Ugandan NGO. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala.
Hello, this is James Butty, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Gambian President Adama Barrow has carried out a mini cabinet reshuffle. This after appointing Sheikh Omar Faye, the former Gambian ambassador to the U.S., as defense minister, the first to fill the post in 22 years. Information Minister Ibrahim Masila says the president also appointed Yankuba Sonko, a former police chief, as the Minister for Interior. But critics say the former police chief is controversial and should not have been appointed. They also say the appointment of the former ambassador is a step backward since he was a key figure in former President Yahya Jammeh's government. To learn more about the cabinet reshuffle, I reached the Gambian Information Minister, Ibrahim Masila.
President Adama Barrow effected a mini cabinet reshuffle, which saw the appointment of a new interior minister and also, for the first time in 20 years, the appointment of a defense minister. The interior minister is somebody who is a seasoned police officer, having served as the Inspector General of Police and also served in various countries as a head of a peacekeeping officer in several countries around the world, East Timor, Sierra Leone, and other places. Now, the new defense minister was also a military officer before, having reached the rank of a major in the Fourth Republic in the mid-1980s, and then also was head of the Gambia's contingent to Liberia during the ECOMOC peacekeeping operations in Liberia. And later he was hired back as a diplomat, being the Gambian ambassador to Washington.
What is the significance of this move in the security arrangement with this prominent reshuffle, particularly in the security apparatus in the Gambia? What message is the president trying to portray to the people of the Gambia?
President Barrow acted within the, province of the constitution that actually gives him the power to appoint ministers for cabinet. And the addition of a defense minister to the current cabinet portfolios, I think, is a strong indication of government's commitment and willingness to move on quickly with the security sector reform that has already started in this country. The question now that we are all grappling with is, what do we do? Is it the right sizing, the down sizing, and the reorientation? So, it is important that you have somebody in charge of that ministry that fully understands the security and security issues.
What are the expectations of the president in this new arrangement, and particularly the expectations of the Gambians with this new cabinet reshuffle?
Well, as always, when the presidents appoint people to cabinet portfolios, the expectation is to deliver, and to deliver, exceptionally very well. And I'm sure when President Barrow considered this appointment, that was not of any difference to what we know of how other countries also do their considerations for people who are to be appointed or who are appointed to cabinet portfolios.
I'm sure you've heard critics of the government saying, why should the president choose a former diplomat who worked under Yahya Jammeh, who was a right-hand man of Yahya Jammeh, who they said was part of some of a corrupt administration that they rejected to come and help with the security arrangement in the country. How do you respond to such criticisms?
Yes, indeed. We have had those criticisms. But remember also, appointment to cabinet is the prerogative of the president. And President Barrow has done a due consultation with the right people that advise him, and they settle for these two individuals. So far, with all the commissions that have been set up in this country, none of them have been implicated in any commissions of inquiry, either in financial transactions or any other thing that may implicate them to the point that they should not be fit for appointment in cabinet position.
Ibrahim Masila is the Gambian Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul.
Want to
to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, a Malawian court has issued an order preventing demonstrators from protesting and holding vigils at airports and border posts. The order, which was issued late Friday, came after the Revenue Authority petitioned the court, saying the demonstrations would significantly undermine revenue collection at the airports and borders. But local media reports the organizers of the protest will appeal the court's decision. The protesters have been demanding Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, to step down or be fired for allegedly bungling the May 21 general election. Meanwhile, Information Minister Mark Botomani tells me the government will not allow protesters to undermine the country's peace and stability.
Malawi is a country that is governed by law, and no citizen in this country is above the law. Therefore, we try as government to make sure that each and every individual, each and every citizen, all those that come outside of this country abides to our laws regarding the attempts to close the airports and the borders. I would say that for us as government, we don't just consider this as an issue of liberty for people to demonstrate, but we are looking at it as acts of aggression on Malawi's borders. And it's certainly treasonous, you know, because it's an attack on the security of this country. That's how we are looking at it. And that's what even the state president, Professor Fatima Mutharika, said 2 days ago in Bangoch.
The Malawi Revenue Authority has gotten a court order preventing the demonstrators from going to the borders as well as the airport to demonstrate, saying that it will impact the revenue collection in borders and airports. What is your reaction to that?
Yes, we're very happy that the judge at the High Court has granted the injunction to the Malawi Revenue Authority and others who sought the court's intervention on the matter, because this is also an issue which bordered on revenue collection. You know, as you know, that the Malawi Revenue Authority is a body that is mandated to collect revenue in our border posts and even at the airport, and of course all other revenues. And so the attempts that were made by these so-called human rights defenders were going to affect these collection of revenues in these places I've mentioned.
There are concerns that if these demonstrations are not allowed to go on as guaranteed by the Constitution, it could further create tension and possibly violence as well. What are some of the measures your administration is putting into place to resolve some of these concerns of these protesters?
It is our expectation that these organizers will respect the court's decision to grant injunction to MRA and others. We don't expect them to, to continue, organizing demonstrations. But if they do so, then they'll be going against the laws of this country. And anybody who goes against the laws of any country will face the law, the arm of the law. The president has already said that he will have to deploy security in those places to ensure that Malawi is protected. So, but like I said, I just hope that these people, especially the organizers, are law-abiding citizens, and they will abide to what the courts have said. That's our expectation.
But is there any plan by your administration to engage some of these organizers or from the Human Rights Defenders Forum? How do you resolve some of these concerns they have as a government?
But we don't see any justification for her to resign. This matter is political. It's not as the people are saying. It is political. And when you say that majority of Malawians are against Dr. Jenas, it is neither here nor there. It is just speculation, because no referendum has been conducted in this country to justify the position of those that say that majority of people are against Dr. Jenas. What we know is just it's a collection of these people who are calling themselves human rights defenders and some political leaders. They are the ones that propagating this move that Dr. Jenas should resign. But we are also surprised because, these, especially the political parties, have gone to courts. Matters are in the courts right now, and it is upon the judges to say that the elections went well or not. So we are surprised that on one hand, they have gone to court, and on the other hand, they're demonstrating against, Dr. Jane Ahnsa and her commission. That's what we're surprised about.
Mark Botomani is the Malawian Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. United Nations Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, says about 8,500 refugees have left Angola to return home in the Democratic Republic of Congo. UNHCR spokesperson Fabian Favorite says the decision to return home appears to have been due to improved security at home, as well as the goal of getting children enrolled for the new school year. He says Angola provided transportation to help with the movements of some of the refugees, while others left on their own. Spokesperson Favorite tells me the UNHCR is working closely with the government of Angola, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and other partners to help resettle the refugees.
We're informed that there are like 8,500 refugees whilst they're trying to return to DRC. So they left the Glovua settlement, which is in Angola's Lunda North province. So they started to spontaneously return on August 18 to go back home. So we know that most of them have proceeded short distances, and that Angola facilitates the transportation of some of them. So since Wednesday, we monitored, and we, according to local authorities, more than 1,000 Congolese refugees who are currently at the border of DRC, which is located 100 kilometers away from the settlement.
So what is the motivation behind their sudden decision to return home?
So basically, we think that there are like two main reasons. So the first one is that there are some DRC officials who visited refugees at Selovua settlement, and they greet them basically about the improved security conditions in the Kasai region. And at the same time, refugees want to go back home, and especially that in September, there's the new school year who's beginning. So I guess that they want to return back home for the school year as well.
Does the UNHCR anticipate more refugees to return because of these conditions that you spelled out?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, so we noticed that we had 8,500 refugees who left the settlement, so which means that we're expecting at least this number to be at the border with the DRC in the coming days. So yes.
What help do these refugees need in order to be resettled in Congo after coming across the border from Angola?
So basically now people need basically shelter, transport, and water and sanitation. So I'm talking about the refugees which are at the border now. So UNHCR is trying to identify areas to build a transit center, basically to accommodate them until further notice. After that, to transport them to their area of origin. But basically, I mean, this has to be done, of course, in collaboration with the DRC government and the Ugandan government. And we need to officialize that with a tripartite. So the UNHCR team in DRC, the UNHCR team in Angola, and both governments, so the Angolan government and the government of DRC, who are at this moment in Luanda, in Angola, to talk about the different modalities to ensure that the people are voluntarily returning to their home.
What has been the response of the government so far regarding the issue of proper planning to resettle them, transportation assistance that they will need for their resettlement, if I may ask you?
So the Angolan government is starting to step up the process. So since the beginning of the week, they are providing trucks to transport refugees, who are mostly women and children, to bring them to the border. But basically, all the modalities and the agreement will be discussed and validated during the tripartite, which should end today, I suppose, because it started yesterday already. Until then, we will know exactly what will be the modalities for this repatriation process.
Fabien Fevre is a spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. Botswana is battling a rise in the smuggling of fuel into neighboring Zimbabwe. Petroleum products are illegal, taken to Zimbabwe through the cutting of the border fence. Zimbabwe does not permit individuals to import fuel despite frequent shortages. For VOA, Ngodisi Dube reports from the Botswana capital, Gaborone.
Botswana says nearly 100,000 litres of petroleum were recovered near the Zimbabwe border in the last month, with the smuggling of the liquid on the rise. The bulk of the fuel is destined for resale on the black market in Zimbabwe as the country battles acute shortages and rising prices. Botswana's energy regulator, the Botswana Regulatory Authority Bera, says it is illegal for people to take fuel to Zimbabwe without declaring the product at the border entry point.
This is a challenge to us as a country because the petrol that is sold in the country is subsidized. And this subsidy is coming at an expense to government and to us as citizens in terms of the tax that we pay. So if people come here and smuggle fuel outside the country, they're illegally getting our benefits.
Eric Rahoeng, a director at Beram, says they'll seek the help of the police and soldiers to patrol the border in order to curb smuggling.
A lot of it has been smuggled into Zimbabwe. So where they're smuggling, you need the police, you need the defense force. Because those people who actually do the smuggling, you find out in certain instances here and there, they are ready to fight back.
Last month, several thousands of liters of paraffin, diesel and petrol were recovered from areas along the Zimbabwe-Botswana border. The Botswana police recorded 157 cases of smuggling, although no arrests were made as the culprits usually flee, abandoning the commodity. Police spokesperson Gottfried Lohelang says they will intensify their efforts to halt the illegal movement of petroleum products.
The patrols are already there. We need a proper and robust legislation so that we can show to those people who will be offended that we are serious on this.
Zimbabwe Energy Regulatory Authority has complained to its Botswana counterparts over the smuggling of petroleum products. Fuel is cheaper in Botswana at about 75 cents, while in Zimbabwe it is around $1. But prices are highly volatile and pumps have remained dry. Despite the shortages, the government has refused to lift an import ban on fuel. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
The United Nations reports nearly 2 months of heavy rains and flooding in Sudan have wiped out livelihood, rendered tens of thousands of people homeless, and created a humanitarian emergency that needs an urgent international response to overcome. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
At least 54 people are known to have died from the torrential rains that have hit Sudan since the beginning of July. Sudan's Humanitarian Aid Commission reports nearly 194,000 people have been affected, and more than 37,000 homes have been destroyed or damaged. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports 15 of Sudan's 18 states have been affected, with White Nile State taking the biggest hit. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says flood victims urgently need emergency shelter, food, health services, and clean water and sanitation. He says vector control to limit the spread of waterborne diseases by insects is crucial.
In many places, families have lost their livestock, which may aggravate already rising food insecurity. Across Sudan, the number of severely food insecure people rose to an estimated 5.8 million at the beginning of the lean season in July this year, an increase of more than 2 million compared with the start of the 2018 season.
Laerke says many homeless people are living with family and friends. Others are seeking shelter in schools and other public places. He tells VOA the government is responding as best it can by providing tents, sheeting, and emergency shelter.
As you correctly mentioned, there has been political turbulence in Sudan of late. I also mentioned that the government has maintained its coordination of the response. It is the government's humanitarian aid commission that is leading the so-called flood task force, which is co-chaired by OCHA.
The United Nations has appealed for $1.1 billion for humanitarian aid for Sudan this year. Donors have provided just 30% of that amount. The UN estimates it will need an additional $150 million to respond to the most urgent flood needs. If that money is not provided, Laerke says funds will have to be redirected from one place or activity to another to meet immediate emergency needs. He warns shifting money around in this manner has a negative impact on the humanitarian operation as a whole. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You are hearing from John Black featuring Vinka with Sweet Love. Then Ricardo Banks featuring Vanessa Mdee, follow with Moo. Samira Said come with Albal. And then Diamond featuring Mr. Flavor with Nana.
Girlfriend, boyfriend. Inside, outside. Yeah.
Girlfriend, boyfriend. Inside, outside. Toca no la mazo bontizo. A to mucha la te vamos sosa. Evin tu vio cola se viñizo. Choca munda momenti mamolín cuesta.
Girlfriend, boyfriend. Inside, outside.
Yeah. Girlfriend, boyfriend. Inside, outside.
Tula kukateve kuweyo kapiticha onirida utukula olinga na lupita. Your lips are nice, your lips are sweet. Njagala digital every day and night. Sagala kwekwasa, every time sagala kunzunza.
Yagala sweet love, baby. Sweet love, baby. Yagala chipe, baby. Chipe.
friend, girlfriend, boyfriend. Inside, outside, inside, outside.
Swans Avenue. Boss man.
Yeah.
baby basi jui tuni kito nani kashuma islamu if we remember
featuring Mr. Flavor with Nana. That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturday and Sunday.